especially, they like to limp. They think that being strong takes them off the market. That somehow they have to be vulnerable in order to be marketable socially. And yet they're the strongest force. Women have such profoundly strong spirits, strong natures, strong beings. And yet they're so afraid to let that strength come to the surface. It's astounding to me. And men, I look at men and they're so hesitant to show their intuitive strength, their inner vulnerability. Like, well, does that mean I won't be able to earn money? If I let sensitivity, I won't be able to make a tough business decision. It'll take the edge off my ability to say, well, you know, business is business. I can't afford to feel for the other guy. That's why they're like that. That's why they don't want to come into the new age field. Because if you have to feel for the other person, you can't make a tough business decision. Okay, we need new models of what it means to be healthy as people, to heal. That health is, it's not an either or. We need to create these new models. To be spiritual doesn't mean that you are poor. Doesn't mean there's an off-planet God that's going to steal your bank account. You can have a mystic's consciousness and a stripper's body. You can be sensual, sexual, and mystical at the same time. And when I look at all of this and what's required, what I realize all the more is that we're coming to the end, not just of a fossil fuel era. And if you know anything about oil, you know we're done. We've come to the end of a mythic era. Our myths are running out of steam. Our archetypes are running out. They can't contain us as humanity evolves to the next level. We aren't contained anymore by a human God that's afraid to be sexual. That doesn't work anymore. Where the image of what is divine is afraid to be touched sexually. Jesus. What if he was a married Jewish man with Mary Magdalene? Would that change the sacredness of his teaching? What are you focusing on? Where his body came from or where his scripture came from? The obsession with the church is it's now destruction. They can't get over genitalia. They've never been able to get over genitalia. His journey was not about his penis, but about his scripture. They've got to stop that. It will be and is the death of them now. The second thing is that we're heading into the era of cosmic or galactic theology, where they need a cosmic theology because we've been earth-centric. And soon they'll admit to extraterrestrial contact. So that a theology that's based only on God on this planet no longer works. And the Catholic Church is already developing a galactic theology because they know about this. Our mythologies are not working. And so too our health, how we understand what makes us healthy has got to include the mystical laws. It has to include how well we're managing truth. And there isn't one model of health so far that includes the role of honesty, integrity, moral conscience, and ethics. None of it comes in and says, I'll tell you why I'm sick. I'm a compulsive liar. I tell you why I'm sick. I tell people I'll keep my word and I never do. I tell you why I'm sick. I cheat all the time. I take things that aren't mine. In a world where you maintain a spirituality that you claim is managing your tranquility with yoga and turn around and betray your friends by how you speak, you can't live in those two worlds anymore. Sorry, but you can't. You cannot have a health code of holism and not get that that means everything. Can't go there anymore. You can't be piecemeal like in the old world and pick and choose and decide, I'm holistic when I'm eating cucumbers, but I am the wrath of God when I'm angry. And I am not forgiving, and I have every right to be that way because I just had a bad childhood. And you can piecemeal yourself like some fragmented Stephen King movie because of the way your ego is set up and not realize I got to deal with this because it is against the theology of holism. And that's the higher law of this realm. It's just a law now. It's just the law of the land. And when I talk to you now about healing and from this point on, as we explore addiction, as we explore purpose and meaning, as we explore all the subject matters that are ahead of us on this, I am talking to you only now from what you need to know according to the laws of this land. For me, it's all about law and order. What do you need to know in the land of mystical laws when it comes to your health? How do you have to understand yourself as an addict? Beginning with the truth, you are one. Period. I'm not interested in what your addiction is. I will begin with this as we start in our next CD. You are an addict. You're born that way. Now, it's a matter of why. Let's understand that and let's go into it together. But in this realm, if you understand that according to law, it's an impersonal experience. It's an impersonal place. In this world, it's a world of law and order, because that, at the end of the day, is the nature of God. God is law and order. That's it. Take the face off, take the myth off, strip away birthdays, get out of your costume parties. Finally, you'll understand that the nature of the divine is universal. It is law and order. Like gravity, like cause and effect, it has no religion. Law has no religion. Action and reaction, no religion. These are the laws that govern your health. Simple as that. But you've got to learn how to use them, how microscopically powerful they are. And that at the end of the day, the most powerful, little, tiniest, and potent of the laws are the laws of grace. And the only melting force of intimacy you have is prayer. The laws are consistent, potent. Can you heal at the speed of light? Yeah. Do you have the courage? Probably not. Can you get there? Yeah, you can. All of this is the way it is. Is it a religious thing? No. It's simply law. It's simply law. This is the new governing force of this land. Consciousness is one word. The more you understand about your infinite self, the more you will finally understand that the ego will call it energy, but your soul will recognize this as grace. Addiction needs to be understood as fundamental to the field of energy medicine, to the field of energy consciousness, to how we understand ourselves in this parallel reality of health, healing, wholeness that we have entered into. hopefully by the time I finish the topic of addiction, what will make sense to you is why addiction is an epidemic. Why I can say to any single person, you are a born addict. You are a born addict. For me, addiction occurs because there is a fundamental misalignment between how your mind perceives reality, whether your heart's in agreement with it, who manages your will, and your capacity to hold the power of your decisions in congruence with creation. You're too addicted to the authority the physical world of illusion, in the language of Buddha, has over you. You are in service to the world of matter, to the world of form, over the world of inner guidance. You're still doing battle in that world. So to reduce addiction to substance, what substance are you addicted to, is preposterous. Because you will simply move from one to the next. You'll get off alcohol, you'll go to sugar. You'll get off sugar, you'll go to carbs. Because you don't get that it's not about the substance. It's about the fact that your entire reality is a relationship imbalance, in that you fundamentally are out of whack with the nature of reality. For you, the outside world commands you. You are commanded by the illusion that the physical world has more authority over you than your inner world. And so long as that imbalance exists, you will be addicted to stuff, substance. That physical world will hold you captive. Be money, power, issues of self-esteem, seduction, substance, weakness. You'll be able to be bought for a price. What kind of addiction do you want me to name? Low character, character flaws. You're addicted to excuses, buying yourself out of jail, procrastinating, negative attitudes, bad relationships, drugs. It doesn't matter if you get that I can only be an addict because I can't balance my relationship with truth. I know that my inner world, my inner guidance is more authentic than the outer, but I'm not strong enough to follow it. So long as you are not strong enough, you're an addict. You will do something. You'll talk to yourself this way. And because I know I'm not strong enough, you will have to find someone to blame. It's my mother. You just did it. It's not me. It's not me. See, it's really not me. Yes, it is. It absolutely is you. But you become addicted to blaming someone else. You'll find addictions are just that way. It's not me. I'm not really like this. I'm this way because why? Tell me. Do tell me. It's my mother. Is your mother occupying your body right now? Are you possessed? Am I looking at a possession? Because I still have connections with priests. I can arrange for an exorcist. You know, I mean, so what are you saying? Is there somebody pulling the strings? Someone that is controlling your choices other than you? So it is you. So you are addicted to this, to making judgments. Addiction means you have relinquished your will to something in the outside world. And you've done that for a reason. And I'm going to go into those reasons because they're all about you managing the speed at which your life changes. The speed at which you perceive reality. Believe it or not, your addictions operate a psychic clock. Your addictions operate a huge psychic clock of creation in each of us. And the coordinates are like, how you see those wheels in a great big huge grandfather's clock. And the more addictions you have, the more these wheels spin, 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 spin. But what they're doing is they're spinning the coordinates that result in the speed at which you perceive truth. Now, I want you to picture your crown chakra, your sixth chakra, and your heart chakra. The speed at which you will become coordinated, congruent, hit your fifth chakra, and make a decision. Because a decision sets a wheel in motion and moves your life forward. Without that, your life, in your opinion, in your mind, in your comfort zone, doesn't move forward. You feel you have more authority over not moving your life forward than moving your life forward, believe it or not. For most people, their sense of control is not about being the captain of their ship, but about keeping it in the harbor. And in staying addicted, saying, I'm not sure what to do. I have to find out more stuff. I have to get another map before I take my ship out. I have to learn more about my ship. Feels like a decision, looks like a decision, smells like a decision, but you never go anywhere. The boat just gets heavier, more weighted down, more depressed. That's an addict, because you don't really want to sail your boat. You don't really want to make a decision and move and go anywhere. That's what's true. You actually don't want your mind to talk to your heart. So in order to stop that, you have to keep shoving something in your throat, in your fifth chakra, so that your fifth chakra always stays in chaos and keeps electrocuting the zone between the head and the heart so that you remain incongruent. But now, I simply want to talk about the addict archetype in general. When did the addict even become the addict archetype? When did that become a part of the social psychic field? Because I can assure you, it's not always been a part of the social psychic field. When the Romans drank like pigs, with Bacchus the god having grapes dripping all over, in the times of ancient Rome and ancient Greece, and these great orgies, nobody said, uh-oh, alcoholic on the loose, alcoholic. It wasn't even a concept. Now let's fast forward centuries and centuries and centuries. Let's go to the courts of Europe. Wine pouring in. And these grand parties, lavish parties. Do you think for one moment anyone said, you better go home to your palace, Louis. We think you've had enough. There was no such thing. As a matter of fact, the more, the merrier. Pretty soon it was opium. Bring it on and bring it in. Whether it was prostitutes, opium, alcohol, it didn't matter. It was the privilege to be unconscious. It was a privilege. It's what you got to do. It's what you were born to do, was to indulge, was to have more than the ordinary mortal. That's what you got to do. That was the privilege of the rank, was to have as much and more than that. That archetype could not have existed then. It made no sense. What are you talking about, addiction? This was entitlement to the max. It would not have fit into the psyche of that day. Not in any way, shape, or form. Then in the West and in the East, things began to change. The 1800s, the Industrial Revolution. That changed a lot, a great deal. It changed everything because it created a middle class. And a middle class had access to spare funds, loose change. Where shall I spend this loose change, spare funds? They began to drink more, indulge more. And the indulgence that was once an aristocratic pastime began to seep into the aristocratic middle class, the upper middle class, as it were. And so pretty soon alcoholism began to develop, and still in that class, it was looked upon, maybe frowned upon, but nothing was said because who was there to say anything as these upper class started their imitation of the real upper class? Because they were longing to imitate someone who really had class. And that's how they became so abusive to the lower class, because they finally had someone to abuse. It's a very fascinating study on the addiction we have to be better than someone else. One of the reasons I study history compulsively, because it's the study of us. It's the study of us and our constantly repeating ourselves. And one of the things that we are addicted to is the need to be better than somebody. Please, God, make me anything, but don't make me ordinary. I'll do anything not to be ordinary. Don't make me ordinary. Do not let me wake up and be ordinary. Please. Thus we become addicted to judging. I'm not like that person. I've just spotted an ordinary. And I'm not ordinary like that person. I am not ordinary. I meet these endless parents who tell me my child's special. No, they're not. They're ordinaries. But I'm not going to break it to them. And I'm glad they're special to them. And my nieces and nephews are very special to me. But I don't expect them to be special to you. But here's the thing. The addiction to specialness is the thing that I find so humorous. When you say, my child is very, very special, I realize what they're saying is this. I need to have my child surrounded by the myth of extraordinary. This is the myth of extraordinary going on. Stop with the mythic soul weaving stuff that is so typical of this age of ours. Your parents, your grandparents, and our elders did not do this. They did not do this egocentric race to specialness by the time the child was 2 weeks old. They did not claim uniqueness of soul to their neighbors and to their friends as soon as this child came out of its mother. It's a classic Pandora behavior. Not only am I special, my child is special. You must acknowledge my uniqueness and specialness, or you do not qualify as my friend. This is an addiction that is a total reflection of who we have become. It's an addiction to our own madness and fragileness, to our narcissism that is so intense that we are so blind we can't even see it, nor can we even bear to go near it and take it down. So intensely are we hidden behind this. Trust me when I tell you, alcoholism is our safest addiction. If you knew the depth of this and the potency of this narcissistic force, alcoholism is a day at the beach, and I buried my brother from it. So I know what kind of statement I'm making here, and I do not make it casually. The ferociousness of how narcissistic we've become in these last 40 years, and how addicted we've become to ourselves as our ultimate addiction. And we don't even see it. We haven't even named it. We're still dealing with substance. We still think substance is our greatest challenge. We haven't even gone near the fact that we've become addicted to our own excuses and weakness and letting ourselves off the hook. We have wishbones instead of backbones now. We can't take anything. We have no endurance. We have no strength. We lack virtue. We lack integrity. We lack honesty. We sit across from someone and you assume that person's going to lie to you in business. You just assume it. You just assume it. We live in a society where speaking truth is likely to get you arrested now. Arrested. That's the kind of society we live in now. We live in a society where you know for a fact that you're being told to take drugs for things and that that's an easy way out. You know that, and you'll cave in instead of standing up and saying, I'm not doing this, while thinking you're on a path to health. How many times have you compromised that and taken the easy way out while telling yourself I'm really healing, knowing full well you've simply caved to the addicted path? Okay, so this role of the addict has become 50% of the psychic field in which we are now living. It's everywhere. It's like an obstacle course one has to go through within oneself, representing a relationship between oneself and the power the physical world has over you. It's really like a Buddhist obstacle course. The topic that I study the most privately is war. I have studied war all my life, actually since I was 9 years old. And I study war and the military because war is the great change agent of society. Our society is no longer the same, and the reason is war. 9/11 and war. And it will never be the same because of war. We've been at war for 9, 10, 11 years. And we won't stop being at war. Wars make addicts. Because they introduce morphine. They introduce drugs. They introduce medicines in a way that were never introduced before. So World War I introduced a field of addiction and a field of madness, began to rumble and earthquake the psyche and the soul. World War I was setting the groundwork for the earthquakes that would eventually become the Seoul we have today, that would eventually become the Seoul that rose up in a revolution in the 1960s. The Seoul that broke through and said, I want sexual freedom. I want religious freedom. I'm going to take drugs and become addicted. I'm going to be free in every which way. I want to throw out every kind of religious boundary. I want to explore Eastern religions. I want to do whatever I want. I don't want anyone saying no to me. I want every level of freedom. And it was in this war that the wounds, the unearthing of the wounds that you are dealing with now, were first jostled as if someone came deep into the collective of the human experience and said, wake up. Come on. It's time to wake up. Humanity is going to dig deep now. Come on. Let's wake up. It would be in the 20th century that evolution would say, it's time to provide the vocabulary. It's time to shut the gap between religious mythologies. It's time to reshape the map of the world. It's going to require two global wars. We have to reshape forces. Now, I need you to just use your wildest imaginations as you stick with me on this, because it's wild. One of the great mystical laws is as above, so below. Your first chakra at the collective level is the chakra of Earth society, right? This is the chakra where wars are played out and nations crush. What is in one is in the whole. This is the chakra where nations crumble. And your first chakra is your tribal stuff. It's attached to collective tribal. You are part of that. As the world changes through its wars and wakes up tribal things, your tribal things are one and the same. We go through in 1944, an event that only happened once before. Oppenheimer splits the atom. It opened up and birthed us in a new universe. It was a second Big Bang. Nothing's been the same since we entered the nuclear age. Nothing. Nothing. We went through a black hole. We literally, symbolically, energetically went through a black hole into this realm that we now live in which nothing's the same. We have a different relationship with time and space. We are moving at an exponentially faster pace. Our finances, though they look like we're still using formulas from the previous pre-black hole era, the fact is, we are talking from madness. You don't need any money down. You don't have to pay for a year. We've taken time out of everything because part of us is literally living without a relationship to time because we can't find it. We talk about energy medicine as the medicine without time. We've created the internet, a form of communication without time. Everything we are trying to relate to has no time in it, and you can sense in yourself that the world that is matter and has time, you no longer have patience for. It doesn't make sense to you. Every single system of technology is something that they're taking time out of. Addiction is about looking for where you are locked into time and where you don't want to come along with it. Now, in the 1920s, this country, it really built an appetite for hard liquor because of prohibition. You know, as soon as you say to someone you can't have something, what do you want? And you want it bad, right? And the wild mob days were a prelude to what would become the psychic depression of the 30s. Because the market crashes in 29. Now, this is really interesting because you have a mental high in the 20s that brings out the dark side of the psyche. All of it's, we can get away with this. We can make cash illegally. Think of all the dark shadow side that came out during prohibition. But then came the depression in the 30s. And that's when the psychic field moved to the heart, the collective heart of the country, the shattering. So the pendulum swung from the collective minefield, where everybody was this irresponsible heart and irresponsible mind. And it swung just like the Tao, all the way to the other field, which was the heart, the impossible, what Americans never thought was possible, happened in the blink of an eye. The stock market fell in October of 1929. There's a lot I can say about this particular event, so stick with me here. And that's that this particular event, like many others yet to come, represents something in the American psyche. One, that the American psyche functions from a position that bad things cannot happen here. It has drunk its own Kool-Aid, a Kool-Aid it cannot afford to drink any longer. Bad things can and do happen here. It's had a civil war. It's had a Great Depression, and it's in one now. And there's no sign it's going to recover soon. It is a nation of addicts. One out of three Americans is in poverty level. One out of three. Our homeless are rising. You can't afford to be addicted to the image of what this nation was and will never be again. That was from another time, another century, and indeed another millennium. And it's over. And if you know history, you know that the elements that came together to make that time happen are gone and can never be repeated. What made America reach that peak moment of becoming a great superpower was because the rest of the world was devastated by war, and we weren't. We became the first global superpower. No other countries had nuclear power, money, prestige. All of that has changed. We aren't the global superpower anymore. We're broke. And the other nations have nuclear power. We have no bargaining force anymore. It's over with. We have no way to make money. And to top it off, our dollar's based on oil, and there is no more. So when you look at what is ahead, you cannot afford to be addicted to what has gone before. You cannot tell yourself that things cannot happen because they have never happened. They can and they will. The Great Depression happened in 29. Took people by surprise because they thought bad things could not happen to them or here. They didn't prepare to ride a wicked storm. now. It was during this time that AA came into being. It was during this time in the 1930s that Bill Wilson and Bob Smith founded AA in Akron, Ohio, during the height of emotional despair in the country. Then came divine intervention, because AA is divine intervention. The 12-step program is, from my point of view, divinely channeled. I think that program has the hand of God written all over it. And so too the timing. Because here in the midst of great despair, when people were in fact just turning to alcoholism, drowning their sorrows in despair, comes a program that says, you'll get through this. You'll get through this. It wasn't just a program, it was a support system. It was a support system. It was a gather together, because you are stronger together than you are alone. There's a strong message in AA, and it's not just about the fact that you have to bottom out and then rise, but that you are stronger in community. Because when two or more are gathered in my name, so too there shall I be. When two or more gather and they pray together, and you look at another person and you say, help me, give me some grace, form a bridge with me, because I am not strong enough to do what I'm being guided to do. And if I hold on to you, it's like holding on to the hand of God through you. I am not strong enough. We can do this, because I can't do this alone. Now help me hold my spirit away from what? What can't I do alone? It could be anything. Name any addiction, anything. This qualifies. Anything that calls you out of your body, that is an addiction. Anything in the outside world that is stronger and unsettles your inside qualifies as an addiction. Done. Anything. Anything that has the authority to throw you a curveball that you cannot stand up to qualifies as an addiction. Anything. It calls you, you know, in the language of Buddha, it is an illusion. That's an illusion. You know for a fact it's an illusion. I'll give you an example. I'll be an example. I can be anyone in your life. I can be your mother, your teacher, your aunt, okay, whatever. I represent someone whose attention you want. Could be a boyfriend, a husband, it doesn't matter. I am someone whose attention you want. You get up in the morning, you bling yourself up. You think all day about seeing me or talking to me. I'm a boss impressing me. I'm a friend you want. Maybe you're hoping that I'll ask you to join us for lunch. Whatever narrative you tell yourself in your head of how that's going to work its way through. And it doesn't happen. We encounter each other for a minute, 30 seconds, 5 seconds. And all I say to you is, hi, gotta go, busy. Or I come home from work. I'm your wife. I'm your husband. No, I don't have time. Look, I gotta work. I'm going out. Made other plans. I'm your partner. I'm your wife. I'm your husband. You made other plans. Wow. No, you didn't call me. No. Oh, sorry. Ah, right. Okay. Got it. All right. We got a choice here. We can be crushed and devastated. Or we can be Buddhist. And if I had you to work with as your spiritual director, this is when I would step in. Step in like a bullet. And I would say, right now, I want you to take a deep breath. very deep breath. Center yourself right now. And I want you to step back with me and see this whole scene as a spectacle. I'm going to whisper in your ear and say, do you want to attach yourself to the spectacle or let it pass you by? This was just an exchange, just words. This person said words to you. What were the words? The words were, I don't have time. I have to go here. Oh, yes, hi, see you later. They were words. You're attaching yourself to words and sounds, and you're creating a whole narrative in yourself, a whole narrative of rejection, and you're attaching the whole of your life to those words. You're creating a spectacle. Here's the word I want you to dwell on, spectacle. And it's a container. You're putting your whole heart into that container. We're creating a spectacle. We become addicted to our own stories. And at any opportunity, we pull out our stories and we fit them into moments in our life where we think this'll work. Here's an opportunity for me to tell that story again. And that moment has nothing to do with that story. Nothing whatsoever. But we hurt ourselves again. It's not that person walking by you that's hurting you. That person had nothing to do with that. Nothing whatsoever. But you've decided, I think I'll go to the archive, pull out that story, and use this moment as an opportunity to tell myself that story again. And then when I'm done, I will blame them for that story that goes back 40 years before I met them. Somehow you will weave this catastrophic event into a drama that now includes them in your childhood. And they were never there. But now they are. Then you get to tell them, you are now part of my childhood. Now I know we just met, but because of my creative weaving, I have made you part of my childhood. And you can join the cast of characters that are all now part of my childhood because I'm addicted to that. And it works. And it's a drama. And it's what I do. And the drama we have created health around these days has given us some permission to depth charge and widen the lens of what we need to be healthy, what we need to heal, and how we get to create these narratives inside of ourselves in the psychic field. But I am convinced that during the 20s, during the 30s, the ground was laid for us to open ourselves to what would eventually become, in this decade, the greatest turning point in the history of human civilization. That's the moment we are at now. If we look back on the last century, and it's funny even to say that because we were there for half of it or a third of it. But looking back on that century, where the groundwork was laid for we, a new species, who needs to manage the integration of the psyche, the spirit, the mind, the body, the archetypal realm. That's who we are. And how to negotiate all of these forces. Even the world wars served as part of the opening for these events. Because war is the language of our first chakra, and because we are creatures of war, and because we wage war with ourselves and with others, and because war is the force in you that is the game changer in your own life, within your family, and within your friends. You wage war. Now, we're going to fast forward from the 30s to the 40s. After World War II, after the second Big Bang, because as a result of World War II, everything in the world and everything in our universe changed. And one of the things that happened was therapy was born. Obviously, we had Jung and we had Freud and et cetera before, but it wasn't mainstream. After World War II, mainstream therapy came in. Why? Because we entered the age of the psyche. We entered the age of the soul. We entered the age of these two being married. We entered the age of the wound. We entered the age of who we were to become now. And it was at that point that the word addict was entered into the dictionary. It was at this point that a consciousness came into view, that it was possible to form a relationship with a substance. And the question was why? It was at that point that we came into an awareness that a human being could have so much inner pain that they would want to drown it out. Prior to World War II, that would have been seen as such a weakness, such an act of shame. But if we look at how the wars changed everything, World War I shifted a sense of collective self-esteem, and it took down the aristocracy. And that's what it was designed to do, was to change the map of Europe and bring down the aristocracy so that a middle class could actually rise. World War II brought down another barrier, and that it gave rise to the inner life. It set the tone for a different kind of response to pain. Because we were victorious, because we won over the bad guys, I'm going to present you with an idea that may sound wild to you. But we entered the psychic age, and the principles of good and evil became psychic forces. They became forces in the psyche in a power way, unlike anything humanity had ever experienced before. It became a force within ourselves. Nobody ever talks about the battle of darkness and light, good and evil, and its role in addiction, but it needs to be spoken of. Because it's very real. It's very, very real. The battle between those inner forces has a great deal to do with addiction. And the absence of someone having a relationship with the sacred and how that perhaps weakens them. Because that draws somebody to bury their fears in substance so that they are not conscious of what they're feeling or what they're sensing or what they could perceive if they saw clearly. After World War II, we opened a field of therapy. We opened a field of, thus, medication. We began the study of the relationship between pain and the inner world. Follow it through Vietnam. We opened the 60s. What happened during that time? The inner child, the victim. Different levels of the archetypal world began to open up. different realm of how we began to speak about ourselves began to open up. And we started to talk about ourselves in a very, very different way. And then we began to create a hybrid spirituality. We made it up. We made up this spirituality. And we created a spiritual path that said the ingredients of the spiritual path were not what they really are, which is a path of inner illumination. We made up this hybrid that said the spiritual path is a path of happiness. What? It's a path of happiness. It's a path of stuff. You can get everything you want. You can? Well, it's a path of happiness and stuff. And it's a path of eternal youth. And it's a path of your highest potential. Where did people get this stuff? I need to know who started this garbage. But anyway, it's a path of all this. And healing requires that all these mysteries get solved. And from this came this idea that somehow being in pain was a mistake, an error, that we swung completely in the other way. That if you were in pain, something was drastically wrong in your life. Someone had made a mistake. Now, there was a very interesting background playing out that I need to add to this. While all of this was happening, something else was happening that framed this, that I think played a role in creating the nation of addiction that we have. And that's that we are the only nation, the only one, that has, at this point, adults, I would say 65 and younger, baby boomers and younger. The baby boomers share something phenomenal, and that's that we're the only people ever in the world to have grown up with television. And of course, the television programs of the 50s, 60s, and 70s had a lot invested in reflecting the perfect and ideal American life. So we had Leave It to Beaver and Donna Reed and Walt Disney, Mouseketeers. And you had My Three Sons, and you had Bewitched with an Aunt Edna or whatever her name was that appeared in the refrigerator. And then you had Mary Poppins, a nanny who popped in. It was the birth of the magical child, the ideal child. While simultaneously the wounded child is the opposite one. Because simultaneously in therapy, where the opposition is that we're giving permission for a society to express its inner pain, to come to terms with how are you feeling, to start scaffolding a model of body, mind, spirit health that says you have to get in touch with your emotions in order to understand why you're not well, in order to understand why you're addicted. The AA meetings are spreading with popularity. And by this time in the 60s, groups of multiple different types of addictions are now forming. Not just alcohol, sex addiction and gambling and food, shopping. The addiction is now spreading different orbits. But it wasn't until the 60s that we began to talk about the inner woundedness. We began to redefine what is addiction. We started to put depth charges to it. We began to realize, you know what? This thing is really more serious than whether or not you have a bottle or heroin or whether or not you have sugar. That, in fact, we are a nation of addicts. That addiction is, in fact, a crisis of our time. It's epidemic. And by the 70s and 80s, we were very seriously realizing that it wasn't just that we were expanding addiction to